Can you talk a bit more about the buddhi? Okay. When we're talking about the antakarana, so I'll give you a Sanskrit. Antakarana means the anta, inner karana instrument. That's what we mean by the mind. We say that the mind itself has four different types of vrittis, thought modifications, four classifications of its own thought modifications, as opposed to receiving all of the data from sense perception, right? So that data from your sense perception is just coming in. That's not a function of the buddhi itself or of the antakarana itself. Things that are it can do on its own, not in relationship to the sense perception. So they say there are four functions. One of the functions is the buddhi, then there's the manas, the citta, and the ahankara. What the buddhi means is it's decisive, clear thinking. It's knowledge as opposed to doubt. Knowledge is stored in the buddhi, or it's that not stored in the buddhi, it's the thoughts which are certain, where there's clarity, those thoughts we call the buddhi. That they all go into that classification, that type of thought. Remember now, when we talk about knowledge, when you say that a person has knowledge, that means that they have clarity in reference to that particular object of knowledge, as opposed to having doubt. And just a simple example that's used in terms of clarity just in my daily life is that if I walk down my steps, I walk down the steps, I stop right in the middle, and then I say, did I remember to lock the door? I'm not clear, I don't have clarity. Did I or didn't I? So I basically, in that situation, I can't make a decision. The manas really can't make decisions, you know, in terms of that fluctuating mind that's doubt-filled. Okay. So that's a quality of the manas, is that there's no determinative thinking at all. So the buddhi would come in and say either, yes, I did. It's clear. It remembers, it's clear, then you can move on. No, I didn't, it says. Okay, then you have to go up and relock. Or it can even say, or lock it. Or it can say, I'm sure I don't remember. That's clear. Yeah. I don't remember. Okay? That's a determination. That's the buddhi. And so when we, as we gain knowledge, even relative knowledge, that buddhi comes into action in terms of decision making or my value system or how I'm going to behave in this particular situation. And so when we're gaining knowledge, even knowledge of karma yoga or atmajnanam, self-knowledge, the one who is gaining that clarity is the buddhi. All of the emotions and doubts and the not being indecisive type of thinking, and also the emotions that we call really the negative emotions, the thought flow, all of that is contained in the manas. Contained in the manas means it's that quality of thinking. There's no decision, there's just a thought flow, also the negative emotions, but the buddhi will come in and make determinations about that thought flow or about that emotion. So when we're doing, for instance, inner child work, it's the buddhi that comes in to be with the little ones inside, because the buddhi has knowledge, knows that it wants to come into relationship with the little ones, so it has that nishtha, it has clarity, you know. And so the buddhi is coming in and going into relationship with what is there stored in the unconscious. So it would be much more the manas, and especially the manas is a lot of all of the negative emotions that can be held. And say those emotions are being held in the citta. But if they were ever, and they were in consciousness, they were the manas. Okay. It means the mind, the fluctuating, non-determinative mind. So we have a buddhi, manas. Citta is just your memory. So everything, every experience I have gets stored in the memory. Most of it actually stored in the psyche. It's not really retrievable to me because I'm taking so much information. But the information that comes into my mind that I'm aware of, right, that is stored into the memory banks, which I may or may not be able to access, but hopefully I can. Yeah, so that's the citta. And with psychology and what we've learned, we can also extend the citta into the unconscious. You know, because we've taken so much data, you know, that then we can say it's stored in the unconscious. You can perhaps, if you want to place it in the citta, people don't know because we don't do that in the Vedanta. So you have to say, where am I going to put this? Where am I going to put this experience in the Vedic paradigm, you know? And you could just say, well, it's a different paradigm. But if we had to put it somewhere, we might put it in. So the last one is the ahankara. The ahankara is a determinative thought. It's like sometimes it's classified with the buddhi, but if you take it just by itself, the ahankara is the I notion, right? It's the I thought identifying with an upadhi. So the upadhi is the conditioning agent where I can perform that superposition, that adhyasa. So I can say, I am upset, I am happy, I am sick, or I am healthy, or, you know, I am this physical body or the qualities of the physical body, I'm not seeing well. All these types of identification are all ahankara, as either I, me, or mine. Right? These are my eyes, these are my ears. My eyes are not as good as they used to be. That's all ahankara, right? So it's where I'm identifying me, the Atma, with an upadhi, something that can take on the eye. So that's the ahankara. So these are four functions that the mind has available to itself that it offers from its own. The antakarana, belong to the antakarana. Buddhi is most important for us in the sense that you're gaining knowledge, and with that knowledge then we can interact internally and externally with our experiences. Even without self-knowledge, you can still divide any experience you have into kind of a seer seeing. Any experience I have, I can objectify it and then come into relationship with it. The one who objectifies it and comes into relationship with it is the buddhi in the work that we do, because I know what I'm doing. I'm certain. I'm objectifying this pain, for instance, and then I'm coming into relationship with it. So the buddhi, and the buddhi is the one who is gaining knowledge, who is performing this act of differentiation as this knowledge takes place. It's recognizing itself and the whole universe as mithya. That's the buddhi. You know, and recognizing, differentiating itself from me, from its own being. You know, and realizing this at satya-mithya relationship. So, buddhi. You know, I think that's pretty complete for now. Once knowledge is there and established in one's buddhi, why continue to study? Is there a higher Vedanta study? That is a good question, so let's talk about that. There's what's called, so, well just on the very positive side, there's nothing really more enjoyable. Yeah. So the thing is, but there's also, so probably, you know, say you may love to continue studying and teaching and having satsang, you know, and so that just continues on just because out of love. There's something else though that's called a Vedanta Vasana. And the Vedanta Vasana means some people have a certain panditya. Panditya means a pundit is a scholar in a given field. So say if you have that kind of drive to know more and more and more details, that's called a Vedanta Vasana. Like you go on studying and studying and accruing all of these details, there are countless texts, countless bhashas that have been preserved and saved, way, way more than have ever been translated. The amount that's been translated is very small. But there would be no way in this lifetime or a few lifetimes that you could read all of the texts that are available and with their commentaries. There's not just one commentary also. There's different bhashas, there's different tikkas, and there's different types of commentaries on all of these texts. So there's no possibility, but you could have an urge to know more and more and more detail. That is arguments, say more and more and more arguments. And somehow, if you call it a Vedanta Vasana, it's not positive. The meaning is not so positive. It means that you're not really in the vision. You know, you're in the texts, and you get carried away and kind of lost in that. That's what we mean by Vedanta Vasana. So that is not the best thing. But the positive side is that, say you do know Sanskrit, or there are a lot of texts available to you, you might really enjoy that study and reading the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. It's so beautiful, you know, and studying the texts, because it's something to do, something nice to do. Also, if you have this knowledge yourself, you probably enjoy teaching also, because when you teach, you also gain clarity. There's a really wonderful, what we call pulla, a result to teaching anything. If you've ever taught anything, you know that. Like, say, whatever it may be, you gain so much clarity, and the knowledge becomes very embodied as you give it out, as you share it. So then say if you're teaching, you will always study. That's part of our tradition. Even Swamiji, who taught the Bhagavad Gita, he had it memorized upward, going from beginning to end and backwards. He used to do that every day, beginning to end and then going backwards daily when he was younger, you know? That Medha Shakti is incredible. And he has, how many times has he taught the Gita? He's fluent and very fluent in Sanskrit. He's taught it so many times. And read all the commentaries, there's lots of commentaries. He enjoys reading the different commentaries. When he teaches it, and when he teaches it, like before he passed it, before he left us, he still opened the books before class. And he read the bhashya, he read the verses, he read the bhashya, he just made it all fresh in his mind. And then He knows it all by heart. But that's what we do. We don't just come to class. Sometimes he would have to because people would be seeing him, you know, and then he would have to go and just wing it, but he really didn't like to do that. For him, it's not winging it, but nevertheless, because somebody would come and from out of town or whatever, they'd have to meet with him, and then it would be past time for class, and then he would just have to go. That happened more and more as he got older, and more, there were more and more people. But his vision, his drishti, you know, his intent was always to study before he came to class. And I think that's beautiful, you know, beautiful thing to do, and that's our tradition. You study. Now for us, for me, I will always read the Sanskrit. I read Shankara. I read Shankara. Shankara's Bhashya, his commentary. I always read Swamiji's commentary, because Swamiji takes what Shankara says and he just expands it. I hope you all have this Gita Home Study. We're sending you chapter 2, right? Does anybody not have it?
So
you're getting it. But you should have. Did we send out?
Yeah.
We sent out. We sent out. Good. I've been waiting for it. It's the best. It is the best. I think so, really. It's so beautiful, so profound, so thorough. Why I'm asking you is because now we're kind of a small group and we're teaching this chapter 2, which is really an important chapter. Chapter 2. It just gives the whole vision, and right now we're in this Karma Yoga and we're going into the Siddha Prajna, the one who has this knowledge, what are they like? It's just an extraordinary commentaries on this. And Swamiji's commentaries on some of these verses, you know, the last few verses are in, they're like 10 pages of commentary just on one verse. It's a lot. Not on all of them like that. There's some verses. This chapter 2 is so thorough. So what would be nice, if you have the time and you have that text, I would read over his commentary just like I do of the verses that are being done. You know, and really take that chapter, take that Gita Home Study seriously, because it's so profound. And you can't find that in writing. You can, when we unfold it, you can find that kind of, if you find that in writing, somebody writing that, it's amazing. So hopefully you can study it, use it to study, especially, you know, when you go, you've study groups around it, and really go through it line by line, because it's so beautiful. So anyway, that's not a Vedanta Vasana. That's for you, for the teacher and for the student. That's our dharma, you know, is to be with these texts. So now, that being said, there's another story about this. Why do you need to study this knowledge after you have it? And the story is, it's very much like, you know, a traveler who comes to a river. Swamiji used the Ganga as the river. So these travelers are on a pilgrimage, you know, up at the, in Rishikesh. They come to the Ganga, and there's a boatman, you know, who will take them across. So they get in the boat. He takes them across, and then they pay him and leave. They don't need to take the boat with them, right? They just need that boat to get them from the one side of the river to the other side of the river. And then it's done its job, right? Nobody puts the boat on their heads and carries it with them, right? It's done its job. And knowledge is like that. It does its job. When it has done its job, when you see, when you know, when you have that clarity and your doubts have been resolved so that your mind is just owns that, you know, and you understand the Karma Yoga, how to do the inner child work, all of these things, these are skills that actually they just become your life. It's not even a skill, it's just what you do. It's just natural, you know. It's natural to you. And so then there is no reason, you know, to carry the all the Upanishads around with you. You know, we can all have them in our iPad now, so now you can do it. But I used to, you know, have these big, like, huge suitcases, like trunks of books that I would have to take, ship over to India, and then bring them back. Oh, my gosh, it's awful. And then even going from the West Coast to the East Coast, when I would go do it with Swamiji in the early 80s, I would have to bring all my books. I needed my books. I just cannot believe the weight and what that entailed doing that. Now we have everything on our iPads, no problem. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're free. You do not need to study, you know. But having satsang is nice, you know. Being with like-minded people is nice. Having a community is something so beautiful, you know. Sharing this knowledge, you know, even if it's Gita Home Study that you're sharing, or if you have enough to be able to give some classes, that's such a beautiful thing to do. So let me tell you a little bit about giving classes, the attitude you can have toward giving classes that allows you to do it. Because if you think you need to be a Mahatma, then you're not going to ever do it. Because I'm just not enough of a Mahatma yet. You know? But that's not necessary. You just have to be a good person. And you have to be yourself, and you have to be able to say, I don't know. And you don't deal with this guru thing. The guru, this person, you know, that you are not a guru. No person, Swamiji is not a guru. Nobody's a guru. They're not walking around as a guru. You have a guru, you know. You have a guru that the one who removes darkness, one who removes the ajnanam, that is your guru. Because they've removed that ajnanam for you. That makes that person your guru. But that person isn't just a walking, talking guru, you know. So we think that we have to be something, you know, instead of just being ourselves, and we are sharing this knowledge with each other, you know? And if we know something, we know it. If we don't know it, we don't know it, and we find out. We have so much access. You can just say, I don't know, I'll find out, let me look into it. It's so easy to say, you know? And you share what you know. You know, and the more you share what you know you know. And you probably had this experience in almost any field. The more you give, the more Bhagavan gives you. You know, the more associations you make when you're teaching somebody, all these little jewels are continually, you know, being given. So just be a good person. You know, that good personness, where I don't have any doubt about us. People come to Vedanta, you know, they're not bad people. They would have no interest in this. People who come to Vedanta have very beautiful hearts. We're dealing with our issues. But that goodness is there, you know? And wanting the best for others, especially if you're in a teacher role or a therapist role, you find you want the best for your students. And as long as that is there, teaching is such a beautiful thing. You have a community around you, you know, you're sharing this knowledge. It means the Vedanta is alive and well in your area. Even if it's only it's alive and well because you're there. Yeah? But it's there, you know. That Sangha is there. So, you know, I would just keep it alive. Don't be shy. Don't think you have to be somebody. I think that makes for a lot of phony people. It's an awful burden. You think that you have to be somebody other than what you are. You know what I mean? So you have to play some sort of a role. That gets old really quickly. Mm-hmm. I have a good story about that. I don't think I've told this one. I may have. I may have already told it, but it's a really good one. This is not just about me. This one's about somebody else. There's this one, kind of a student who I've known for many years. He's probably my age. He might even be somewhere, you know. He's older, he's not young. But he's been just teaching whatever he knows, and he has not really studied Vedanta very much. he's been into a lot of different things, a lot of Neo-Vedanta, and kind of dabbling in this and that and this and that. But, you know, very, very eccentric guy, but also very, very loving, very well-intentioned, okay? But a dabbler and picking up a little here from this group, a little here from that group, a little, you know, like some of these Neo-Vedantins are doing the Shaktipat and stuff, and go! You have knowledge in it, that kind of stuff. So he had all kinds of this stuff there. Okay, so he has for several years has been giving a lot of satsang and just sharing and talking with everybody and singing Pali bhajans and things. And once in a while he'd come to my class. You know, he'd always be so glad to see everybody and he'd be glad to see him as well. Very eccentric. Okay, so anyway, he went to one of these particular teachers, I don't really remember who it was actually, that he's had some association with, and something happened in the class. There's a whole bunch of people there listening as this kind of, you know, you are Ananda, be happy, go in peace, that type of teaching. You know? And something happened, some sort of a absorbed experience that was very highly, very, very profound, life-changingly profound, deep, meditative, samadhi-type experience. And everything was so clear, you know. And so he gets home and he sends a letter out to everybody on his mailing list and he says, I have to make an announcement. I got this letter. I have to make an announcement. This is what happened. I'm now enlightened. And I just wanted to share it with all of you that I'm an enlightened being, you know, and I want to celebrate this and I want you all to continue coming to class, but to realize that this has now happened for me. You know? He's completely serious and he's completely good hearted also. But he's a little eccentric, you know. So he says this and he's so thrilled and happy. And you can tell because this letter goes on, you know. And so I'm reading this and I'm thinking, oh, wow. Okay, but anyway, I don't see him that much. He only comes occasionally, maybe two or three times a year, I assume. I said, okay, see what happens. So now I don't hear anything for another 3 or 4 months. And we get another email. And he says, I'm sorry, but I made I'm sorry, but I made a mistake. I thought I was enlightened. But it went away. And he wrote a beautiful letter and he said, but let's just keep our satsang. But you know what? I thought, what a great guy. Yeah. What a great guy, you know? Because he's so honest. Yeah. You know? He's so honest and he really meant it the first time and he really meant it to, you know? So, just being himself. But he also didn't have really traditional teaching. He had experience-based teaching. You know, and that's, you know, that's really problematic. I think I did tell a story when I was first in with Swamiji, maybe the first yajna that I went to in Ahmedabad after having that 4 days meeting with him. I went to this yajna in Ahmedabad, and you know, I was listening so intently. I was just so totally focused. And I did have like a big experience where everything just became so clear. And I saw everything. But I had no experience. I hadn't really been with Swamiji very much. And so I thought at that time, I thought that was experience was it. And now I'm enlightened. Now I know. Because at that moment, everything was so very clear and my mind was kind of in an altered state. And to me, that was it. And then, as I walked with a couple of the other students to the satsang home where Swamiji was staying, It was maybe, I don't know, 10 blocks away. This is in Amrabah. And as I was walking this in this enlightened state, all of a sudden, everything was fine, and I noticed it, and I didn't want to notice it. I really didn't want to notice that, but then I did notice it, but I tried not to notice it. And it went... And then... And by the time we got there, it was just me. And I was so sad. I was crying and everything. I couldn't even go into the satsang I was sitting. I couldn't control my tears. I was so sad. You know, and I didn't know what had happened. I didn't understand. And I was out there crying. And there was a couple of other little issues going on, too, with some crazy guy that was bothering me. And, oh, I was weeping outside. And the satsang hadn't started, and Swamiji came out. He must have wondered what was going on. Maybe he heard me outside. And he came out and he just stood there looking over the veranda, you know. He was like over there. I was weeping here, and he was over there just looking out at the veranda. And he said something like, "Is anything wrong?" Something. And then I finally was able to tell him everything that happened to me. And then he said something like, Don't worry. It'll be okay. I'll explain all of this. There's nothing wrong. You'll be okay. You don't understand how that whole thing works." Something like that. He said in his own loving way. Mm-hmm. I talked to him about this other silly thing that was bothering me. So nice. He was so simple, you know, and just shy. He was simple and very shy. I didn't know him very well at that time. He was just simple and very shy, and he didn't want to impose on this weeping woman, you know, weeping girl, actually, you know. But then he wanted to help, and it was just such a beautiful, beautiful experience. But, I mean, I could relate to this fellow. You know, because I went from this enlightened being to this me in a matter of probably 20, 25 minutes. That's true.
Mm-hmm. Rather, there's a second part to that last question tucked under the corner there.
Oh, is there a higher Vedanta study? Not that I know of. The higher Vedanta, if you want to say higher Vedanta study, it would be that Panditya, where you have the fluency in Sanskrit. And then there's certain commentaries and texts that you can study, like Advaita Siddhi, Naishkarmya Siddhi, you know, there's Brahma Siddhi. It's a very, you have to know a lot to study those. You have to know a lot of logic, and you have to know Panini, you have to know Panini and all of them, it's helpful to know, but the logic you have to know, you won't know what they're talking about, or the teacher has to know. But it gets into a lot of culture, but a lot of detail. The one that Swamiji teaches us is Naishkarmya Siddhi. That's really a useful, accessible text, but Brahma Siddhi is like this big, and Vaita Siddhi, and they're huge texts. But I don't know, so I don't know another. I think we're doing that. The only thing that is, if you want to think of it as missing, which I don't necessarily even feel that way anymore, is it is nice to know Sanskrit. You don't have to know Sanskrit. The reason I say you don't have to know it, it's nice to know it, but you don't have to, is because of so many of Swamiji's texts that he's taught very traditionally, using all of Shankara and all of the major commentators, not just Shankara. He has unfolded all of those, you know, and they've been transcribed and edited. And so all of the Upanishads, we also have Paramarthananda, who is very, very traditional. And so we have those texts, those MP3s, the audios, and also a lot of transcriptions of those texts. So if you don't have the fluency in Sanskrit, actually, I don't think you're missing that much. But some of us love Sanskrit, and it's a real boon also to have it. It's a great punya to have it. But I don't have that feeling that you must have it. But what I would suggest that you do have in terms of Sanskrit, if you can, is it would be nice to have the script, to be able to read the script, and to be able to have proper pronunciation, to know how to chant, to have fluency. Like if you're looking at some Sanskrit, you can just read it. That takes a while, you know. It has to, for that to happen, it has to become embodied in you. Just like English, you read English, you don't even think about it. Well, Sanskrit has to become embodied. That takes a while. And I guess why I say that, and maybe this isn't even relevant anymore, is that say you were to go to India or study at the ashram, you know, or study with Brahma Prakashananda or Paramarthananda, the texts that they pass out are Sanskrit texts, they're not transliteration. Yeah. And so you want to be able to know the Sandhi and be able to follow along, right? And so if you can, if you're not somebody who really loves the language or you don't have that calling, so to speak, to do that, because it's a big, long-term study, I think everybody, or most everybody, can accomplish that much. Now, the other thing, though, is that more and more transliteration is coming out, you know? And what was really shocking to me when I was in India a couple of times ago, you know, I was happening to sit in the class that the sisters were teaching and chanting. I just was there seeing what they were doing, and I was sitting there. And what I noticed was some of the Indian students that were chanting the, you know, the text that is usually in Devanagari, in the Sanskrit script. They were chanting it in their own script, which is the same as you chanting it in the English script. Because whether it's in the English script or it's in the Tamil script or the Telugu script, whatever, it doesn't really make any difference. It has to be pronounced properly, whatever script you're using, right? And so you have to learn the proper pronunciation, whatever the script may be. And so that's what broke for me this commitment that you have to learn the script, you shouldn't use transliteration as though there's something wrong with that. There's really nothing wrong with it. Yeah. But it is really fun to know the script. And also then you have access to all of the texts. And if you're in India, they probably will not be passing out transliteration. On the other hand, all the temples, and for the temple chants, we have transliteration. You have transliteration, it's using the English script instead of the Devanagari, the Sanskrit script. So it's saying the same thing, but you're reading it in the Sanskrit. So, you know, it's just a different era. When I was with Swamiji in the beginning, there weren't any books that were of any use, you know, that we would rely on, nothing, and there were nothing was transliterated. It's only Sanskrit. You kind of had to use Sanskrit. You had to have the Sanskrit to have access to the commentaries. But I consider Swamiji's commentary so far superior to whatever you can get in the Sanskrit, because he says everything that's in the commentary and expands it. See what I mean? So it's not this, oh, I don't know Sanskrit, so I can't teach. That's just not true. It's not true anymore. So about the higher study, I don't know. I don't think so. Do you know anything?
I don't. I just heard Swami Vagishananda saying, we were asking him what he was listening to, because he likes to sit up and listen, and he's constantly listening.
Yeah.
And studying and all that. So
that's because there's so many texts we can listen to.
Yeah, and he was telling him, and he just, somebody asked him, and he just said, it's higher than all that. I never got a chance to ask him.
Well, say. What he would mean is that it's higher Vedanta. It's not that it's a higher form of Vedanta,
yeah.
But that to, well, it's like this. If you were to study the Brahma Sutras before you had studied the Upanishads, and if you had no logic and no understanding of Nyaya or of the different darshanas, then that text is really, you'll get something, but it's really not available to you, really. You know, it's like you don't know how to add and subtract, but you're doing algebra, and then you're doing algebra, but you can't, you don't, you haven't, he uses this type of example, you can't do calculus because you don't have the knowledge to be able to do it on that level. But it's still not, it's not a higher Vedanta, it's still the same Vedanta, you know, but you don't have all of these different texts to in your mind to know what they're talking about. And the darshanas, like to, you need to have some, and usually in the 3-year course this is taught, the darshanas are the basically the 6 philosophical systems. There's the Advaita Vedanta, the Mimamsa, which is really the analysis of the Karmakanda, the first portion of the Vedas. Then there's yoga. Then Sankhya. So Sankhya, yoga go together. And then there's the Vaisheshikas and the Nyayaikas. These two are related to each other. They depend upon each other. So those are the 6, they're called the Shad, Shad means 6, the Shad Darshanas, that are what we call Astikas. Astikas means they accept the Vedas as a Pramana. But then there's other Darshanas, there's more, but the 3 major ones are the Bauddha, the Buddhists, and the Charvakas, which are materialists. You know, there's nothing but this world that we experience. And then the Jains, which is an ancient religious tradition. You know, but they don't accept the Vedas as a Pramana. So there's these in the Brahma Sutras, they're dealing with these darshanas. And in fact, in Shankara's commentaries, they often deal with the darshanas. And so you have to have some familiarity with them, because they are taken one by one and negated. That's why. So you won't even know what's a Vaisheshika. So you have to know something. But it's not a higher vision. No,
I didn't see it as that way. It was something to know about that statement. What exactly?
Yeah. There's another thing called Vedanta Paribhasha, I think it's called. And that's a beautiful text, which is a deep analysis of the Pramanas. And that's kind of a confusing also, that text, because there's a lot of what we call Purvapaksha Siddhanta, where you predict, there's an objection, then there's an answer, then you object, and there's an answer. And so by the time, then your mind is just like, oh. There's a lot of that, but it's not a higher Vedanta. It's just like going from grammar school to high school to college in terms of the level of the text that you've learned, but the vision is not higher or different. I've been asking Bhagavan the same question for some time now, and I can't clearly hear him speak back to me. I wonder if you could talk about the fact that he might be talking back to me, but that I don't hear him, or that he is actually not talking back, since the time might not be right yet. Well, you know, like when we do this inner child work, and then you ask, does anyone have anything to say? And then you just kind of relax, and often they'll start talking, right? And sometimes they'll be quiet, but often they'll start talking. So then you know they're talking back to you. When you're talking to Bhagavan, you know, again, you're addressing it inside. And I think maybe there can be more hesitancy, more fear around letting your psyche just say what it is. So one thing you can have, one way to think about this is when you're like asking Bhagavan, what, you know, I'm not sure what to do in this situation, what do you think would be the best thing to do? Is to not worry at all, whether it's you talking, whether it's your unconscious talking, whether it's an archetype talking, or whether it's really Bhagavan talking. Don't even bother with that. Because just see what comes to you, and then see if that resonates and is helpful, you know. Because it can be from an archetypal level of your deep psyche, all of the things that you keep learning about Bhagavan, that's what's coming through. But it's coming through kind of the wisdom archetype, you know, wisdom structure in the psyche itself. which is where everything you know about Bhagavan is stored. So it's not necessarily that Bhagavan is from on high, is coming down, entering you and talking, you know. So just make it kind of simple. Like what, you know, just what, like this, what comes to me? And just keep practicing with that. What comes to me when I'm evoking Ishwara? Because that is different. You're evoking that part of your psyche that is wisdom, that is Bhagavan, as opposed to invoking the little ones inside, you know. Then you're directing your attention toward that part of your psyche. And so doing that, then just let what comes come. If you still feel like nothing is coming, another thing to try, and again, don't try to objectively, is this really Bhagavan or not? Just take what comes, and then you see if it resonates with you afterwards, if you get anything from it, right? Or if it seems off the wall, you say, this certainly is not Bhagavan. No. You have the freedom to do to make that decision. So sometimes this writing, you know, or writing or even typing is good, where you type out. I've actually done a lot of this, and we do it in Jungian psychology, Jungian work also. You can type out just, and just for clarity, for instance, you can type out in small letters your question and in caps the answer. So you can have a conversation with Bhagavan just through typing or through handwriting. So if it's handwriting, you might put me, B, Bhagavan, or something, M for me, and B for Bhagavan, or however, just to differentiate it. But when you're writing, that also somehow taps into the unconscious when you're using your body. It's just slower. I like to use the typewriter because it's faster if I do that. But you write a question, and then you just let whatever answer is there, just let it come. Whatever comes to your mind, you just type it down. And you write, yeah, but what about this? And you just keep that conversation going. And be free with it. Don't worry. Don't let that inner critic come in. You know, the one who's thinking, is this real or is this not real? You know, is this just me? I'm just making this up. Jung had a lot of problems with this originally when he was doing active imagination. Or he was really going inside and kind of, it was kind of very similar to shamanic journeying within the psyche, you know. And so he would come in, all of kinds of things were happening, and he was a very kind of visual person. But then his mind would come in and say something like, this isn't real, this is you, just you making this up, you know. He writes about this, you know, you can, when you're reading everything in his 20 volumes, what you can look up in volume 20, it's a, what do you call it, an index of all 20 volumes. You can look up active imagination and then just read all the things that he says. And there's three or four places where he talks about this problem, you know. And finally what he did is he just told that part of the psyche, just be quiet, you can come later. You can be a critic later. But now, just let me do this process and don't worry about who's saying what. You know? Don't worry about if you're unconscious or if you're making it up or all of this kind of thing. Don't worry at all. You just do it. And he was able to overcome that because it is kind of like an inner judge, an inner critic, you know, who's saying this isn't right. Yeah. And then that would stop that process. So you have to kind of practice loosening up. So we worked a little bit on this today in the meditation, just kind of introducing it. So it's actually, if you think that from a physical level, it's easy to understand that this physical body is part of the total physical universe. It's made of the same material. Right? It's made out of food, actually. So that this body is part and parcel of this physical universe is clear. And is really contained within the laws of the physical universe. You're not outside of those laws. So this physical universe, if we look at it kind of from the standpoint of the whole manifestation, we look at it as Virat, as Ishwara's physical form, right? Then some form that the one where the five elements have not gone through this process of grossification, that's subtle. Physical means the five, space, air, fire, water, earth, have gone through a process that we call panchakarma. It's become physicalized. If you don't know about that, I can go through that at some point during this month. So that's the mind, the sattva and rajas, the mind and prana and organs of action and sense organs are all subtle, right? But they are part and parcel of the subtle part of the creation, the subtle aspect of the creation, which is called Hiranyagarbha. Okay? And so that's like the intelligence principle. It's like the conscious mind that embodies the physical, if I were to try to make an exact parallel. From the standpoint of the whole projection, subtle and physical, it's not like there's this physical body and that there's a subtle. But there is a subtle and a physical as part of that manifestation. So your mind is very much part and parcel of the subtle body, the total, what they call the samashti, the total subtle body, Hiranyagarbha. And so you're not separate from that wisdom. You know, you're in relationship with all of that. You can call upon it. You can call upon your deep psyche. You don't really understand where the psyche stops and the external to the particular psyche begins. You don't really know that. And it doesn't really matter because there's so much wisdom even in your deep psyche. But to just let yourself come into that dialogue and relationship and to, in prayer, have that prayer be real. You're praying about or talking to Bhagavan about what it really matters. And you don't know what to do here. You know? And you ask, what should I do? Or how should I handle this situation? And then just see what he says, but you have to loosen up a little bit. And let it be you or whatever. And don't worry about it. You know, and just start getting kind of used to communicating in that way without, how would I say it? Like, say you think like this, Bhagavan's not really going to communicate with me. I'm just me. I'm not good enough for Bhagavan to actually come here and communicate with me. You know, I'm not spiritual enough, but it's like that. I'm not this or that enough. Bhagavan's not going to communicate with me, so I'm just making it up and silly. So there's all kinds of little things that can get in the way. You know. But none of that's real. That is not real. What is real is that you are Bhagavan. You are Bhagavan, right? You, as a wave is the ocean, it belongs completely. There is no separation there. You know, and so I would just be free to have these communications and your buddhi, and this is what Jung says, he's very good at this. He says, you know, your buddhi will know if the advice that's being given to you is off or is not dharmic. You will know clearly. So just let what comes come and be free. You know, and then you'll find you can really breathe. You can really have deep relationship with the whole creation on every level. It's so beautiful, but you have to just let yourself be free and not worry too much about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Having a karma yoga attitude, or a question about having a karma yoga attitude and leaving. So... Oh, I see. And learning to have samatvam, is it correct that the emotions we do still have when a result arrives are themselves part of the karmapala? And so we can, while experiencing the emotions, also stay objective toward them and accept them as a result something we can't change? Well, I think the emotions are really kind of a result of my expectations. You know, so it's a reaction. On the part of the jiva srishti, it's a reaction that's generated based upon my expectations. But if I have that karmapala, I mean that samat prabuddhi, I can accept those reactions as prasad also. That's when, you know, when you say in a lot of these exercises we do to welcome your emotions. You know, and it's also here, it's welcoming Bhagavan, it's prasada buddhi, it's like this. You know, I welcome what comes my way, and then I respond objectively to it in a helpful way. With Bhagavan, I just accept the results. And I have that attitude, of, you don't really know what's good for you. Bhagavan knows. So, one priest, who's a good friend of mine actually, he team taught some classes with me some years ago, and he used to say, there's always a yes behind the no. The Bhagavan says no, you know, but there's a yes. He's closing this door, but then what's been opened, you know? And so to not be really disappointed when you get these no's, because actually that's assuming that you know best. You know, I find we have to be patient. We do not necessarily know what's best. Probably not. Probably what actually happens is best. And we discover that as we go along, you know. That yes behind the no, you know. Or when something that to me is so terribly painful or hurtful growing up, or when you're young, you know, or even when you're in your early 20s, as a pretty... not really hard years for most people, teens and early 20s, you don't have any idea what's going to happen. You know. So, some of the things that happen in those early years, you know, are very, very painful, but in hindsight, you know, there's some, I still have one or two things that I actually wish didn't happen. I wish it had never happened. One thing in particular. I wish it had never happened. Or I would even say before, I would be better off if that had not happened. And I said that for years, that I would be better, much better off if that hadn't happened. But I don't feel that way anymore. You know? I think that that thing that was so very, very difficult, was something that happened in my more teenage years. But that thing actually, you know, it gave me a lot. I don't know. It was a lot to deal with, but it also gave me a lot of depth, a lot of compassion, just a lot of deeper areas in my psyche. You know, it's not that it wasn't hard, and still I kind of wish it hadn't happened, but I don't really anymore, you know. So you change as you grow older because and are more with your knowledge perhaps, because you start to understand that there's something there to be learned. It was your karma, you can say. But it's not just that it was your karma. It's that you learned something that has made a difference for who you are today. And that's kind of the treasure, to find that, because that releases you from saying, I would be better off if this never had happened, you know. And usually things aren't so bad that you actually say that. That means it's, to me, that means it's pretty bad if I'm going to say that. I would be better off if that had never happened. Yeah. But then you are who you are because of all the experiences you've had, and you start to value all of those things. It's interesting. I like that.